From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The demand for nurses in the Sunshine State is high, with 12,000 vacancies. A new report from the Florida Center for Nursing indicates the need for nurses will only continue to grow across the state in the coming years. We'll take a closer look at the report's findings as we explore how local healthcare systems recruit and retain nurses during unprecedented growth. Plus, thawing diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba are opening doors for new collaborative scientific research. Last year, Moat Marine Laboratory scientists, along with their Cuban colleagues, began a satellite tracking study to follow sharks. We'll explore what scientists are learning from that project. And we'll also hear the remarkable story of what happened to a Florida woman after she was bitten by a shark. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. For the remainder of the hour, we turn our attention to sharks. In December of 2014, President Barack Obama and Fidel Castro announced steps toward a normalization of diplomatic relations that's led to expanded research opportunities, including a study between Moat Marine Laboratory researchers and their Cuban colleagues to track the movement of sharks through satellite tagging. Moat researchers traveled to Cuba in 2015 to place the first satellite transmitter tags on sharks in Cuban waters. Joining me now for a closer look at what new information that research effort may have garnered so far is Dr. Robert Huter. He's a senior scientist and associate vice president for research at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, where he also directs the Center for Shark Research. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, John. It's good to be with you today.
Good to have you with us. And listeners can join our conversation about tracking sharks in Cuba. Call 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or tweet using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And I read that you've been trying to get permission for this effort for at least 5 years before it happened. What finally enabled you to get the green light? What barriers did you have to overcome?
Well, I started working in Cuba in 2005, so I've been there in the country for more than 10 years. And for the last, as you point out, at least 5 years, we have been trying to get permission to deploy these electronic devices that we use rather commonly in the United States called satellite tags that allow us to track the movements of sharks. And the Cubans just would not permit the use of those because they were labeled as satellite equipment. And when you enter Cuba, you actually, on your customs form, have to divulge any kind of satellite equipment because they're very restrictive about things like GPS units for a variety of reasons. So we always had trouble getting permission until actually, and interestingly, we got the Cuban media involved, and it was Cuban television, a channel essentially called Mundo Latino, that helped us get permission. Had quite a bit of clout in Cuba and helped us get permission to go ahead and put these out. And once we got the first ones out, we kind of broke the door open, and I don't think we're going to have any trouble from this point forward.
And I'm really interested in just the physical process. How do you actually find, capture, and tag these sharks?
Well, we find them in a variety of ways. Sometimes we go out and fish for them ourselves. In the case of some of this work on the south coast of Cuba, we were actually diving with the sharks. We actually used a technique that I personally had never seen before in my 40 years of studying sharks. There was a dive master on the south coast in a place called the Gardens of the Queen, an absolutely fabulous coral reef area on the south central coast of Cuba. And this dive master had developed a technique where sharks that were swimming by at the dive site, he was able to gently grab their tails, the upper part of their tails, and had a technique where he could restrain them and hold them without being bitten. And we ended up using that technique to actually measure and then tag the sharks in his arms. And as we applied the tag, the sharks would then take off. So This was all filmed by the Discovery Channel, and actually was on Shark Week last July, and it was a pretty fabulous experience, and the first time that sort of technique has ever been used.
Wow. Well, yeah, certainly a braver soul than myself to use that particular technique. Tell me about, you know, how many and what species of sharks have been satellite tagged through this effort.
Well, in Cuba, we've just satellite tagged two species. More common shark called the silky shark, which on the south coast of Cuba visits the reef areas. And this is an open ocean shark that's not usually seen too often by human divers, except in certain circumstances, such as around oil rigs and artificial reefs. But mostly an open ocean shark that we know very little about in terms of their movement. So we tagged a number of that species on the south coast, and then on the north coast we were able to get a satellite tag in a very rare animal called a longfin mako. Longfin makos are kind of special to this area. They're found around the world, but they're not abundant anywhere, and we don't know what their population status is. So getting a tag on that particular shark was really exciting and a great step forward.
Any interesting findings from the tagging study so far, or things that maybe we didn't know about how sharks move or where they go?
Well, the silky sharks showed some very dramatic movements into deep water from the reef. So it showed us right away that they were not just, you know, spending their lives in this shallow reef environment, but were going down to below 600 meters depth at night. So it indicates how deep habitat they need and exploit, and also how cold the water, because the water gets pretty cold down that depth. They're moving offshore. The longfin mako, on the other hand, is more of a long distance mover, and that one shark in 5 months took a path that took it up to the United States from Cuba into the Gulf of Mexico for a period of time, over to the Mexican coast, and then up into the Bahamas, through the Bahamas, and 5 months later, when its tag came off and reported its data back to us, the shark was basically off the coast of the Mid-Atlantic, off the Chesapeake Bay.
Wow.
So in 5 months, it connected with four different countries and essentially swam from Havana to the Washington, D.C. area. So I named it our ambassador shark.
Yeah. And why was it important for you to do this kind of research, you know, in the waters around Cuba? What does the Gulf Caribbean ecoregion represent in terms of the world's shark biodiversity?
Well, there are about 100 different species of sharks in the Gulf of Mexico and Caribbean Sea, or in the waters around Cuba. So that represents about 20% of the 500 species that of sharks that live in the world. Very rich area for shark biodiversity. It's also an area that has been subjected to a lot of fishing pressure on sharks, and the status of sharks in our area has been worrisome. A lot of gains have been made on the U.S. side to rebuild shark populations, which are necessary for maintaining ecological balance in the oceans. In Mexico, I've been working for about 25 years to help them with achieving sustainability in their very large fisheries. And in Cuba, it turns out that even though Cuba is a smaller country, they have a sizable shark fishery as well. And we have been doing this work to advise them about the status of the sharks in their waters and come up with a plan of action for achieving sustainability there. Beyond that, the fact that right here at home in Florida, that we're so connected through the environment to Cuba, even though we've been disconnected politically, these animals travel back and forth. Our tag returns, our tag tracks show this, and not just sharks. It's many other kinds of organisms, marine organisms, that use the Straits of Florida, not as a wall, but as a bridge between our countries, to go back and forth between our nations. So we share a lot of resources, and it's important then to do the research to develop management plans which are to mutual benefit for both countries.
Right. Cuba released its first national plan of action for sharks last fall. Can you tell us anything about that plan and if the U.S. has anything comparable?
Yeah, this National Plan of Action was a major step forward for Cuba. It brought Cuba to a leadership role in the world community of marine conservation. This is a very visible and open document that's part of an international effort to get plans of action around the world, and it has a number of action steps. It's not just a paper plan, but it's a real strategic plan to better study sharks, understand the status of the resource, and build a model for sustainability within Cuba that balances the needs of fishing with things like ecotourism and the need to have just sharks in the marine environment for ecological balance. So this was 10 years, after 10 years of work by folks like us at Moat and many others, many of our partners, we're thrilled to see it in place. And now I'm actually on a path now to implement the parts of the plan that involve research with our partners at places like the University of Havana. The U.S. also has a national plan of action. We've had one for a number of years. We're pretty much at the forefront of shark conservation and fisheries management now in the world. We took a long time to catch up, but we're pretty much near the front of the pack. And so we're a good model for how these animals should be managed, how our fisheries should be balanced with the needs for ecological balance in the oceans as well.
And you'll be returning to Cuba, it sounds like, to continue perhaps another phase of this.
Oh, sure. I go to Cuba about a minimum of about 4 or 5 times a year, and the next trip will be designed to try to put out more satellite tags on the north coast. We're also launching a new project down there, use of underwater camera systems to document sharks on the reefs down there. That's in conjunction with a worldwide effort that's going on to look at shark abundance on reefs all around the world. And we're going to continue our work looking at the fisheries landings of sharks and assessing what the impact of those fisheries are on shark species. So, yes, the work will continue. I love Cuba. I love the country. I love the people. The system obviously has some great flaws and challenges, but it's a joy to work there. And pretty soon it's going to be open to a lot of probably severe impacts from American tourism. So we want to be positioned so that we can help to gauge some of those impacts and maybe provide some policy recommendations that minimize those impacts.
And I know currently you're talking about in the future now, more development, more tourists going there. But currently, how would you describe the general health of Cuba's marine environments compared to, other Caribbean nations or even our Gulf waters here around Florida? From what I understand, they've had some policies in place, science-based policies that have been pretty good in terms of maintaining a healthy marine ecosystem and a lot more pristine than what you'd find in other Caribbean nations.
That is true, and so little of the coastline is really developed. I've sailed along hundreds of miles of Cuban coastline, and you see stretches where you don't even see any kind of a structure on the beach, on the coast. And if that were Florida, I can't imagine what it would look like. It would be so different. They've been insulated, for better or for worse, from the kinds of development that have gone on in other places in the region, and that has had a benefit in terms of helping the environment be sustained. They themselves, the Cubans, made a decision a while back to put more than 20% of their marine coastal areas into protection zones, marine protected areas. It's a very forward thinking kind of an approach. It's again sort of leading the world in terms of marine protected areas. So what you see is a lot of places that are like going back in time. I mean, in some ways it's like going into a time machine to go down to Cuba in many ways culturally and historically, but also in terms of the environment, to see these places that it's hard to find in the United States at this day and age. The places that, and for example, reefs that look the way they did in the U.S. 50 years ago. Now, that's not to say that Cuba has no environmental issues and is absolutely pristine. I think this is sometimes exaggerated because they do suffer from problems like overfishing at times. But by and large, it's a fabulous country, and it is like a time machine for the marine environment.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the program. But thanks to my guest, Dr. Robert Huter. He's a senior scientist and associate vice president for research at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, where he also directs the Center for Shock Research. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you, John. You're welcome.
We end today's program with the unique story of a Florida woman who was bitten by a shark nearly 12 years ago and the amazing transformation she faced as she recovered. This story comes to us from Wyoming Public Media's podcast, Human Nature.
I was kicking wildly to get it off, but it just bit down harder. I couldn't tell what was happening, and I couldn't see anything. And so I'm screaming with my arms outstretched, "It's got me, it's got me."
From Wyoming Public Media, this is Human Nature, the podcast that explores where humans and our habitat meet. I'm Caroline Ballard. On this episode, we'll hear about an animal. A big animal. With a PR problem. Let's face it, sharks are scary. So scary, they can turn the most dedicated nature lover against them. Ask Debbie Salamone. Debbie worked as an environmental reporter at the Orlando Sentinel.
I mean, I covered manatees, I wrote about the Everglades, and I did do a lot of stories about development and how development would be impacting the community environmentally.
How fulfilling was that work to you?
Oh, it was extremely fulfilling. I mean, when you feel like you're making a difference, it really is just the ultimate for your work. I mean, you really hope that you can leave a lasting impact.
And like any good Floridian, Debbie loved the beach.
I spent most of my upbringing at the beach. I loved the ocean, bouncing around in the waves, and I never really gave sharks a second thought.
That is until one day in August of 2004.
It was one of those really hot, muggy, sunny summer days where you just want to get into the water. Well, I was there late in the afternoon and swimming. But in Florida, as everybody knows, an afternoon thunderstorm can roll in at any time. So it started to get a little bit cloudy and overcast. And then I could hear a little bit of thunder in the distance. And I thought, oh, okay, it's time to get out. Because you certainly don't want to get struck by lightning. So I turned around to walk toward the shore. And then all of a sudden, this big fish just jumped out of the water right next to me. And as soon as I saw that fish, I thought, uh-oh, that's really not a good sign. All I could feel were all of these slimy, slithering bodies going around my legs and in between my legs. And then the next thing you know, a shark was just on the back of my foot. And I was kicking wildly to get it off, but it just bit down harder. I couldn't tell what was happening because the waves were churning up the sand and I couldn't see anything, even though I was only in waist-deep water about 50 feet off the shore. I thought, my gosh, you know, I could be in the middle of this feeding frenzy. I don't know how many sharks are even down there. It just felt like there was all kinds of things down there going on. I just couldn't see anything. All I knew is I just wanted to get out of there. And so at this point now, I'm panicking. I'm realizing what the situation is, that there is actually a shark on the back of my foot. And so I'm screaming with my arms outstretched, "It's got me, it's got me." And
I don't really know when it let go. I just couldn't tell. I thought it was back there eating my foot. So I'm trying to get to shore, but every step I take is becoming more difficult because the water's getting more shallow and I can't put any pressure on my right foot. The front of my leg is now folding over the top of my foot. And I knew something was just horribly wrong. And so my companion there, he grabbed me by my hands and just started dragging me through the water and then sort of picked me up and then dragged me some more. And eventually I collapsed onto the sand and I only had the courage to look back once. I could see my foot just going in different directions. It was just completely mangled and shredded. They're just big hunks of flesh kind of hanging off. There was all this blood staining the sand and washing out with the waves. And I just looked around and I stared down at the sand. Unbelievably, this nurse was taking a walk and she came along and she saw all this blood and she heard the screaming and she jumped into action right away. She grabbed my beach towel and wrapped up my foot and meanwhile, now the storm is coming and it's the thunder's really loud and the lightning is cracking and it's windy and the tide's coming in. So we have to keep crawling on one knee and two hands to try and get up out of the water while she's holding onto my foot, keeping it elevated.
Eventually, the rescue workers showed up and took Debbie to the hospital. But her worries weren't over, because Debbie was also a ballroom dancer, and she loved that just as much as her journalism work.
What did you love about ballroom dancing?
I just felt like ballroom dancing was a great expression of emotion that you could just fly across the floor and be creative in the way you move, and you know, you could just dance with reckless abandon. Especially after spending a week in the newsroom, you really need that kind of thing. When I was in the emergency room, I really was afraid I was going to be permanently damaged. Of course, I was screaming, you know, I'm a ballroom dancer, you know, please make sure you fix me right. The Achilles, actually, it was just completely severed, and so then it popped back up into my leg so that the surgeon was able to reach in there and pull it down and reattach it to the bottom part that was still in the foot.
Whoa. That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, I got out of the hospital after a few days. I come home and I'm sitting on the couch now with my leg elevated in this huge bandages. And it took a long time to be able to walk. Walking's one thing. Dancing was going to be another thing because that really requires so much of the foot. So I really was very worried all that time that I'm sitting here in the house and in my closet, there are my beautiful ballroom dance gowns and my high-heeled shoes. And I'm thinking to myself, will I ever get into those shoes and dresses again?
Worry turned to doubt, and doubt turned to anger.
As time goes on, I became more angry at the shark. You know, how dare this shark, especially me, the environmental journalist who's all about conservation and making sure that, you know, all the animals are taken care of and the land's taken care of and the ocean, you know, is conserved. Here I'm the one who ends up being attacked by the very thing I'm trying to protect. I started questioning my whole dedication to environmental conservation. And I can even remember being driven to the doctor one day and looking all around me at all the pavement and the roads, and I thought to myself, you know, pavement is good. You know, pavement's not so bad. And at that point, really, if there was a proposal to, like, pave over half the ocean, I really would have been fine with that. I was really frustrated and angry. I remember
making plans, thinking, okay, next August, on a year's anniversary of this attack, I am going to go out and eat shark steak in revenge because I'm going to be on the top of the food chain again. So anyway, here I am, just like sitting here with my leg up and I can't move. I'm scooting around the house on my behind just to get something out of the refrigerator.
Then, for Memorial Day, the editors at the Orlando Sentinel asked Debbie to write a story for the beginning of beach season. The pitch? Going back into the water for the first time since she'd been bitten by the shark.
So I went back to the beach, and I met up with the nurse who had helped me. We held hands, and we walked into the ocean together, and I can't think of a better way to go back in than to go with her. It was really very meaningful, and I felt at peace with the ocean. I knew that I could be comfortable there again. It was a way for me to let go of the anger, the frustration, the fear. I could have that relationship again with nature that I had so valued through most of my life and felt that I almost lost. Sharks aren't by nature coming to eat you. Most shark attacks are a case of mistaken identity, which is exactly what happened to me. The fish that jumped out of the water was a lot smarter than I was. It got out of the way, and there was my foot looking awfully fish-like. And it happened to end up in the shark's mouth, and it was just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. With these shark attacks being so rare, about 80 people worldwide each year attacked by a shark, why on earth did it happen to me? And so I'm thinking and thinking, and I felt like there had to be some kind of a reason. And I felt like maybe this was really just a test. That's what I decided to see it as, a test of my commitment to environmental conservation. And if I could overcome this animosity toward the sharks, then it would really prove that I could be an ocean advocate and that I could be an environmental advocate.
And Debbie started to realize she was not so much a victim of sharks, but rather a victim of bad luck. Now Debbie works with the Pew Charitable Trusts in their Shark Conservation Initiative.
I know that I can make a difference. I know that I can use my experience to get the word out that sharks are in terrible trouble. I mean, 100 million sharks are killed each year, mostly for their fins to make shark fin soup. They take a shark out of the water, slice off the fins, and sometimes it's dump the animal back into the water while it's still alive, where it drowns or bleeds to death. And about half of all species are headed for extinction. So sharks just have this terrible PR problem. And they got these big rows of teeth, and to a lot of people, they are not attractive at all. And they're very scary looking.
Are they attractive to you?
Yeah, you know, they've actually kind of grown on me because I didn't necessarily think they were too attractive, but yeah, they have kind of grown on me. And now that I know more about them and what they're able to do, and I do see a beauty in them. And these animals are in need of someone like me to speak up for them. They really need help.
And not just from Debbie. She's recruited shark attack survivors from all over.
A lot of them lost arms and legs. They almost died. Their experiences are 1,000 times worse than mine, and yet they are shark advocates. And that is just amazing to me that they all agreed to be part of the group, considering what they went through. They wanted to make something really positive out of something that was very tragic.
They've even presented at the UN and the U.S. Capitol.
We're a really big hit wherever we go, because when you see a bunch of people without arms and legs walking around in matching t-shirts that say Shark Attack Survivor for Shark Conservation, we really get people to pay attention.
So in the end, the shark goes from attacker to victim. Debbie's anger has turned to advocacy. And although her injuries persist, she even got back on the ballroom dance floor.
Oh, it was just so wonderful to be back on the dance floor. I can't even describe the elation to be able to do what I loved again, to have that freedom, be able to move. I was so grateful. I can't even tell you. And even to this day, I'll walk through a parking lot going into the grocery store, and I'll think to myself, so happy I can just walk.
Our storyteller was shark attack survivor Debbie Salamone. You can learn more about her work at pewtrusts.org.
The story we just heard comes to us from Wyoming Public Media's podcast, Human Nature. That's all the time we have. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and AJ Leonard. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.